Studio direction was by Ian Deely and the editor was Rosie Seed. Green and pleasant lands are at the heart of today's edition of Plants from Roots to Riches, now on Radio 4, in which Professor Cathy Willis, the Director of Science at the Royal Botanic Gardens, Kew, continues her major history of our changing relationship with plants.
With the ever-increasing pressure on land for food, fuel, urbanisation and population growth, landscapes that are often most at risk of threat are the small pockets of green, be they copses surrounded by fields of crops, green sites surrounding the edges of towns and cities, or village greens and public gardens. These can be seen on satellite imagery all over the world. They often represent small islands within vast areas of urban or agricultural sprawl. The reason for their existence is often a legacy of the past. Often, but not always, these areas are relatively poor in biodiversity. If they're a dedicated wildlife reserve, for example, they may be managed for just a few iconic species or a particular type of landscape. So when we're thinking about biodiversity and the ecosystem services that these landscapes provide, is there any value in them? And when it comes to deciding which landscapes to convert for other uses, should these be at the top of the list? Controversial stuff, but something we all need to address, given that most of us, the world over, will have run-ins with planning officers on this very topic sometime in our lives. Of what value are these landscapes and the plants they contain? Take the botanical gardens here at Kew. Richard Barley is the Director of Horticulture and has been considering the place of green spaces like these in society.
Really, the role of a modern botanic garden, I think, is an amalgam of a range of things, from scientific work on plants, conservation of plants, building public understanding about plants, but also providing a physical space in which people can relax, enjoy, admire the beauty of plants and landscapes, and learn and build their own understanding. So it's really a rather lovely combination of factors that almost open up more and more the more you look at them.
But this combination hasn't always lived in Sylvian harmony. Joseph Hooker, Kew's famously tetchy director in the latter half of the 19th century, expressed serious concerns about the recreational use of the gardens.
Its primary objects are scientific and utilitarian, not recreational. This is no place for mere pleasure or recreational seekers whose motives are rude romping and games.
No wonder Darwin described his friend Hooker as impulsive and somewhat peppery in temper. Historian Jim Endersby takes up the story.
In the 1870s, one of the gardening magazines published a cartoon which showed the high wall around Kew, the public in great crowds excluded, and inside a handful of botanists wandering around examining plants. And they complained that Kew had been treated almost like a private garden, a happy hunting ground for various scientifically inclined members of the Hooker family, and that the public, far from being satisfied, as Hooker claimed, were in fact excluded. So there was a good deal of tension, and it really came to a head when the railway got here. Lots of people came down on the new trains to Kew, expecting to be able to enjoy the gardens, and found that they were actually shut until lunchtime, so that the scientifically inclined members of the Hooker family and friends could enjoy a little research in peace and quiet. The British public, being the British public, took themselves off to the pub, relaxed and enjoyed themselves until the gardens opened. And it was, I suspect, the sight of people passing out in the shrubberies in a drunken stupor that persuaded Hooker that perhaps opening early and even opening a tea shop might be the lesser of the available evils.
On a more sober note, as well as providing a source of inspiration and recreation, there's plenty of research evidence linking the value of green spaces to mental well-being. For a long time, there's been anecdotal evidence to suggest that green spaces can make positive contributions to our health, help with stress, boost our natural defences, and help us to concentrate. But is there any science to support this anecdotal evidence? And what type of green space and associated biodiversity do we need? For example, is there a difference between walking on a golf course, forest, or moorlands? We also don't know about the state of that green space. Does it have less of a health benefit if it is degraded? In response to these questions, Rachel Bragg, who is the Deputy Director of the Sustainability Institute at Essex University, has been undertaking research to assess the mental health benefits when exercising in different landscapes.
We had some people looking at beautiful urban scenes, beautiful countryside, or countryside that had been polluted in some way, and obviously a control group that just looked at a blank wall while they ran or walked on a treadmill. Certainly for all the groups, exercising on the treadmill made them feel a bit better, but the groups that were looking at the more beautiful rural scenes and the beautiful urban scenes felt much better. We looked at blood pressure, we looked at self-esteem, we looked at mood, and we found drops in blood pressure, which was interesting, and obviously, exercise has an effect anyway, but something we did find that quite surprised us is that people who were looking at certainly the polluted countryside photos started to feel worse, actually, than if they were looking at a blank wall.
The results achieved in these experiments are now being translated into practice. So-called green care is becoming an increasingly established part of all sorts of therapeutic and social programmes. Prisons and hospitals alike now have gardens. Plants and the landscapes they provide are an essential part of this cultural service.
We found that people who started off with lower mental health, if you like, who perhaps weren't so well, seemed to find the bigger improvements having spent time in nature. So that led us to look into specific nature interventions that work with different vulnerable groups of people to see what the effects that was having. And depending on the client group and the improvements that they're seeking, we have found right across the board improvements to mental health and to how people feel about themselves. We've found a sort of a reduction in feeling isolated. A lot of these interventions are group interventions. And so people ask all the time, well, is it the nature or is it the being with other people or is it the activities? Is it being really engaged with nature that does it? And I think that it's a combination of all of these factors all working together to have these wide-ranging benefits.
Building in the benefits of nature is becoming an established part of many disciplines, including town planning, architecture, education policy, and much else. But another benefit to human well-being provided by particular landscapes, forests, and individual plant species are those that provide religious and spiritual value. For centuries, the world over, certain aspects of biodiversity have been valued and conserved for their spiritual significance. In India alone, there are thought to be over 14,000 sacred sites, managed and protected by local communities, often containing rare and specialised trees. Some are many centuries old. Shonal Bhagwat of the Open University studies the legacy of these sacred groves and their increasingly important role in the rapidly changing world of modern India.
Their cultural role or their spiritual role is important as much as their role in binding the community. So many of these sites act as hubs of community activity. And also they provide habitat for wildlife. They provide groundwater storage as a service. They have medicinal plants, other what foresters call non-timber forest products. And existing cultural values surrounding these forests rendered them a kind of sacredness because of their important services they provided.
So these sacred sites can provide vital ecosystem services of many different kinds, not only cultural but also regulatory, for example, affecting local hydrology and microclimates. But are they also important for the conservation of plant biodiversity? It's a question that Shonal has examined across sacred sites in India.
So I started by looking at a comparison between the biodiversity hosted within this network of patches and biodiversity within a formally protected reserve, controlled and managed by the government. What I found was remarkable because even though these are small fragments of forest and surrounded by paddy fields and other cultivated landscapes, they actually had biodiversity value very similar to the larger forest. But I think even though one single sacred grove may come across as insignificant for conservation of nature, if you look at these as a network of different sites, then that network has enormous value. Our modern-day conservation areas, national parks and wildlife sanctuaries, do a great job of nature conservation, but they also leave a lot of gaps in their coverage on Earth. And so sacred natural sites are important in filling those gaps where protected areas are unable to serve that purpose.
Along with aspects of mental well-being and spirituality, it's long been acknowledged that connectedness to nature also provides educational benefits. Even Kew's Joseph Hooker had to rather begrudgingly acknowledge that an apparent gradual improvement in visitor behaviour here in the gardens was due to
the natural beauties of the place and the evidence of system and order with which the visitors are confronted when entering the gates, and the proof these afford of the solicitude of Parliament and the public that everything should be well-ordered and attractive, as well as instructional and scientific.
And gardens and green landscapes are still providing this important educational service. But there is a fine line between education in a strict sense and learning through nature, and all of us probably have experienced at some time of being dragged around a dusty museum or botanical garden with clipboard in hand. At Kew, we now have 100,000 schoolchildren through the gates each year, along with 1.3 million other visitors. So how do we link this role of beauty, biodiversity and environmental education?
Creating interesting plantings is about weaving together those threads of colour, form and texture in ways that are intriguing. But the components of that, I think, need to tell a story, need to be significant in one way or another. For Kew as a botanic garden, given that people are more likely and more used to seeing plants growing in parks and gardens, they perhaps take them for granted. And so our challenge, I think, is to coax them into questioning things. So after they leave Kew, if they're walking down the road and they look at a tree or a shrub or some annuals and they think, now what's going on there? What's that? Why is it growing like that? I think then we've had a small victory.
Inspiration in nature can come in many forms, from the 250-year-old cycad tree in the palm house to spectacular complex displays. Here at Kew, there are plans to redesign the main pedestrian spine. Its new borders at 330 metres will be possibly the longest herbaceous borders in the world.
That will take several truckloads of plants, I can assure you. We will propagate a lot of the material here. At Kew, we have quite significant quantities of plants that are held in our living collections out of public view. And one of my objectives through doing this is to see what we can actually bring into the public realm, particularly in our main pedestrian areas, because these were designed for people to walk slowly and admire the beauty of plantings on either side of the path. Beauty can catch people's attention, and then using plants that have other stories we can tell, we can add the other layers.
Recreation, health, spirituality and education, they're all part of the cultural services that we get from nature. And although some of this might appear a little tree-hugging and unscientific, the influence of these on our desire to conserve biodiversity cannot be underestimated. Whilst the types of landscape and their management vary widely, from neatly manicured botanical gardens like Kew to unmanaged wilderness, even the wildest places often bear the imprint of past human activity. For example, in the UK and Europe, many are the direct result of historic farming activity, whether it's the axe, the plough or the scythe. And many of the plants that thrive in them need human disturbance to allow them to germinate. Think of how poppies spring up when a field has been ploughed or a hedgerow cleared, or, most movingly, when the battlefields of northern France were laid waste by shelling a century ago. And it's this mosaic of open landscapes that we turn to next, and understanding the role of biodiversity in providing us with resilient crops for the future.
Plants from Roots to Riches was presented by Professor Kathy Willis. The reader was Clive Hayward and the producer was Adrian Washbourne. After the news, it's the Archers and the Loxfest PR machine gets a bit of a spanner in the works. Then the afternoon drama. His mum telling Chloe the truth about the absence of her dad, or is she holding something back? In The Man Inside the Radio Is My Dad. That's at 2:15.
When Rupert Murdoch bought the failing Sun newspaper and turned it into a tabloid, many people thought he was mad. But by the late 70s, the Sun was a roaring success, with its page three girls, outrageous headlines and considerable political influence. Some years later, it was to make a massive misjudgment of the public mood, which resounds to this day. In this week's reunion, I'm joined by former Sun journalists to discuss the glory days and where tabloid journalism is today. That's the Sun newspaper in The Reunion, on Sunday morning at 11:15.